Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing today?
Hey, Mona. I'm doing great.
Great. We have something a little different. We thought we would take a little break from some of the what's going on the Hill and all of the tips and everything relating to the filings and have a podcast on an area which actually is starting to be more and more important.
And that's probably the litigation, right?
That's right. Well, the first of a few on litigation. Today on our show, we have Brad Banas and John Waston. They're both litigation attorneys, and they have specialized in suing, guess who? USCIS. Brad, John, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here.
So, Brad, perhaps you could just give a little introduction as to what you do.
Sure. John and I kind of come at immigration law from a little bit of a different background. At different parts in our career, we both represented USCIS as their defense attorneys in federal court when we worked for the United States Department of Justice Office of Immigration. Our job was to travel around the country and defend their decisions, their policies, their actions. And though John and I worked there at different times, we both ended our time there both focusing on defense of employment-based benefits. And so now that we're both in private practice, we've been able to use that experience and that past litigation to really figure out the best ways to now sue USCIS.
Actually, I should really just for our audience, because when you say employment-based, people really don't understand what that is. So if we just back up for a few moments. So all of the, you know, EB-5 is an employment-based visa. Employment-based visas are all EB visas. You have your EB-1, EB-2, EB-3, EB-4, EB-5. EB-1 being for extraordinary ability and multinational, EB-2 being for skilled workers, EB-3 being for unskilled workers, EB-4 for special workers, and of course EB-5 for our investors, which we really are focused on. Brad and John, you have really been a lot more busier than usual lately because there has been a lot more activity in your arena.
John here. Yes, the current administration has kept us quite busy. There's been a series of new rules that have come out, policies that have changed, and also the agency has intentionally been slow rolling how long they take to adjudicate and approve petitions, which has made it a pretty fertile and necessary field for litigation and advocacy.
Well, EB-5 is a little different from some of the other areas because people have invested. And if someone has invested in their own project, for example, and they've put money in and they can't be in this country and there's a delay in adjudication, then of course they're feeling the loss.
It's an interesting cross-section because, you know, you have one side of the political spectrum that is always sympathetic towards immigration. And then you have the other side of the political spectrum that is very sympathetic to money. And there, here you have a confluence of the two things together, which I think makes the EB-5, it gives us some different arguments in court that are very beneficial and that I think are attractive to both sides of the political divide that are sitting on and appointed on the bench. So if we're in front of a Republican judge or a Democrat judge, we have good arguments to bring to bear, especially in the EB-5 context.
Well, a lot of our listeners are overseas, gentlemen, and there is this fear of suing the government for many of these countries that our investors come from. I think the first thing is retaliation. If I sue the government, will the government now deny my case just because I have sued? Is a question I have heard over and over again.
That's the first question we get every time. And I always answer it with the same two scenarios. The first is, after leaving Justice Department, I went to work for USCIS at the Administrative Appeals Office. And I would review potential litigation cases. And potential litigation case was code for be very, very, very careful in how this case is adjudicated because we might get sued. And the agency was terrified of getting sued. So it was code for don't deny this case, if at all possible.
We have been seeing retaliation, or rather bad faith RFEs, in response to lawsuits, John, right?
So what we see most of the time, probably in about 70 to 80% of the cases that we file, the agency will reopen, send an RFE, and then approve the petition. So there's this thing called the Equal Access to Justice Act. And the Equal Access to Justice Act, EJIA, allows the plaintiff to get attorney's fees from the government if you prevail in court. Now, if the agency is just going to turn around and approve the petition right after the lawsuit, they might conceivably be liable for attorney's fees because there was no justification for what they did. If they have the fig leaf, so to speak, of, no, we based our new decision off this new evidence that we requested in the RFE, that's why it's approvable now, then they don't have to pay EJIA fees. So really, in my opinion, what's going on with all these RFEs is just a fan dance. The agency is trying to hide the fact that they have an indefensible position and they're trying to make themselves look a little better in court.
Right. And just for our audience, the agency changes with the administration, correct?
The agency itself, USCIS, will stay pretty constant.
Because you were part of USCIS, John, right?
Yeah. And I was going crazy on the inside, to be honest. That's why I had to get out.
He's on the other side of the fence. Or maybe the other side of the wall.
Well, we could say he came from the dark side, Mark.
Yes, indeed. No, so it's amazing how consistent across administrations USCIS tends to be. Although I will say that in the current administration, it has taken a turn towards the bizarro, I guess, is the only way to describe it. They have just really let the most aggressive, to use a polite term, interpretations of statute and regulation to just run
wild. I can totally agree. I mean, you just have to take one look at some of the blogs, as well as even taking some of the RFEs that we have seen, people have sent to us. Some of these RFEs are crazy. It's like, you guys are already behind. Why are you wasting so much time digging up stuff in these RFEs, are these really on the correct standard?
Brad here. The other protection from retaliation you get when you bring a case in federal district court is that a government attorney from the Department of Justice is actually assigned. And so that can be an attorney with a local U.S. attorney's office, or it can be an attorney from Maine Justice, where John and I used to work. And their interest is very different than the interest of the agency. They don't have the myopia. They don't have the absolute desire to defend agency policy to the nth degree. They have an interest in saving face in federal court and protecting their client from themselves on occasion. I can only speak for myself, and I think John would agree, but if I had ever had a client when I was a government attorney, a CIS adjudicator or regional counsel, call me and say, okay, we're really mad they sued us. We're going to issue a 75-page RFE and really show them, my immediate response would have been, absolutely not. Do not email me that. Do not do it. Have your supervising attorney call me, because you are now putting yourself and your agency at significant risk of liability, because there is a doctrine of unconstitutional retaliation. A federal agency cannot retaliate against someone for exercising a constitutional right, such as petitioning a court to challenge a decision. And so having that extra layer of protection of a disinterested attorney from the Department of Justice, whose interest is, again, to protect the client from themselves and save face in federal court, I really think that's a significant protection that people don't, that applicants don't realize is really there. And it's a voice and it's a contact that will answer phone calls, answer emails on the outside of the agency that can really make things happen, which is why we see so many of these settle. And when we say settle, as John noted, we mean either a reopening and approval in the case of a denial, or just an RFE and a positive decision in the case of a delay.
Well, that's very, really good to know. But it's a shame that one has to resort to litigation to get to that stage. But I feel like that's where we're at, unfortunately.
It is. But I think it's typical in every other area of administrative law in America. Social Security is rife with litigation.
You say America's benefits. A litigious country.
Thank goodness for that, right? But that's true. You know, you look at every other industry, and they have a very active lobbying arm, advocacy on the Hill. And they also have a very active litigation bar, whether it's the oil industry against EPA or, you know, logging, mining, whoever, whatever the industry is, they have a dual approach to advocacy. What we had seen in the past with immigration is they would engage with the agency very frequently, but that engagement really never benefited anybody. And because they never were active in litigation across the board, the agency was emboldened to try crazier and crazier and crazier things because nobody ever stood up to them in court. So now we're starting to see that tide turning where people are getting into court more often and challenging and pushing back on things. And the agency, as a result, I think, is starting to get a little bit more cautious in the way they roll out policies.
Well, that's interesting. We actually had Ron Klasko on the on our podcast series a few episodes ago, and he was discussing a lot about delays because Ron does a lot in mandamus applications. So I got the impression that a lot of lawyers are actually waiting for the particular period of time that USCIS have on their website to expire prior before they go out and litigate. You both have a very different attitude towards this. I believe that you feel like 2 to 4 years is not a reasonable amount of time.
No. And honestly, for an immigrant visa petition or an immigrant visa benefit, we're looking more at the 6 month mark is when we start to consider filing a lawsuit.
6 months? That's not giving them a lot of time.
That's exactly the point. The reason why, and for non-immigrants, it's 30 days. If you look at the way the Administrative Procedure Act, which is basically the handbook for the government, how the government has to behave, it says in there very clearly that the agency, when determining how long to take in adjudicating something, they must consider the necessity and convenience of the petitioning party when determining how long they're going to take. So if you include information about why it's important to your client to get a speedy decision, then that becomes a very useful tool later on down the road. Delay cases are really analyzed under this five-prong test from a case called TRAC versus FCC, I believe, TRAC v. FCC.
TRAC is a T-R-A-C-K?
TRAC, Telecommunications Research.
And Action Center.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. My acronyms were failing me. So the way that these factors line up tends to be very, very favorable towards plaintiffs in the immigration context, because a lot of the standard defenses that other government agencies are able to employ are not applicable to to USCIS, primarily because they're a fee-based agency, and so many of their fee-based agency where the agency can increase manning to accommodate increases in workload, whereas other agencies have to wait for appropriations from Congress.
Well, delay has been a big issue in this last year, because I can say that this last 1 year, we, and we're not uncommon with some of the other attorneys who do deal mostly with EB-5, we've hardly received anything from USCIS as far as approvals have been concerned. And when we recently had the stakeholders meeting, after some period of time, I may add, with the IPO, the excuse we got was that A, the government shut down, and B, we were sort of getting additional staff prepared and trained, really did not seem to justify this huge delay.
Well, I think the most technical way to answer that is liar, liar, pants on fire. Because they're a fee-based agency. They charge you for every petition that you file, and that's what funds their operations. The government shutdown, when I was a USCIS employee, there was 3 government shutdowns. We never lost a single day of work because we don't run on funds from Congress, or they did not run on funds from Congress at the time. So when the agency says that the backlog is due to the government shutdown, that's blatantly false, because the government runs, or the USCIS is, a fee-based agency. Unlike other agencies, say like EPA, Environmental Protection, they run on tax dollars, and they're limited by how many tax dollars Congress gives that agency. USCIS has a completely different financing mechanism, which is they're required to increase fees, which they've done several times in the last few years, to ensure that they meet Congress's expectations for processing times. And the Congress in the Immigration and Nationality Act says that we expect you will get this done in 6 months for an immigrant petition, in 30 days for a non-immigrant.
So, John, if the backlog is not due to the government shutdown or partly due to the government shutdown, what is it due to?
It's due to them trying to find any way to slow down legal immigration.
Really?
There's no other explanation. There is an intentional move by them to delay, and preclude as many people as possible from getting immigration benefits.
Wow. This is one category, apologize if I sound condescending, but this is one category which was termed the red carpet visa, because we're looking at investors who are really bringing in capital and jobs in this country, which is something that, you know, the country needs, every country needs.
Yeah. It boggles my mind that we're trying to get rid of the upper echelon of the world who are trying to come here, invest or work. There's no rational explanation for what's going on. So it's definitely a good place to be in court when you're challenging something that is completely irrational and the judge is looking at it and the judge is impartial. Our positions tend to be more persuasive than the government's lately.
And I'll just chime in. This is Brad. One of the other reasons why we feel comfortable challenging it before the processing times have elapsed is that a lot of these cases, all of the fundamentals of the project or the regional center have been approved time and time again. And the only thing USCIS should be looking at is source of funds or investor specific issues. And we think they're reconsidering everything every time in violation of their own deference memos.
We know. Well, we're seeing this. And in fact, it's not just USCIS. It's consular processing and it's across the board.
Well, and that's right. And that's why it's extremely persuasive to walk into an Article III judge, someone appointed by a president, and say, well, Your Honor, there have been 85 investors in this project. 80 have been approved on the exact same fundamentals. And now all of a sudden, this one's being denied on a fundamental issue. And that's very persuasive to a judge, because I don't want to be the DOJ attorney who has to explain why in this one particular case, we're acting differently or slowing down when they've already made all of these decisions very quickly. And the actual analysis that the adjudicator has to do is very, very narrow. John mentioned these rulemakings about the fees and finding out or setting the amount of filing fees. Part of what they do there is identify how many man hours it takes to actually decide a 526. So Mona, how many hours do you think it takes an adjudicator on average to decide a 526?
Well, that really depends on how a 526 is packaged, because we've seen some very shabby 526s in which it might take an adjudicator close on 48 hours, or ones where you should be able to see within 20 minutes.
Well, in 2016, they reported 6.2 hours. 6.2 hours is what it takes to decide a 526 on average.
Okay, so taking that argument, yeah, it is. But taking that argument, let's, on average, and we know that 90-something percent of all cases are regional center cases. That would mean that they would adjudicate the project once, and then they should adjudicate each person's source of funds separately. So it shouldn't take them 6-point-something hours to adjudicate a source of funds.
And that's why I think the higher end of the adjudicating hours are maybe the first handful of applications that go in for a regional center. And then after that, it should drop off precipitously.
It should.
Because they should not be reconsidering the fundamentals of the project or the regional center. And again, that's why John and I take the position. 6 months is our starting point. And if it's a regional center or a pooled investment where deference applies and a lot of people have already been approved quicker, then the standard is whether the delay is arbitrary and capricious or unreasonable. I don't know how a delay that applies to people in the same project differently can be rational.
Right. And I don't know if you really understand, but we obviously deal with a lot of investors and the circumstances are such that a delay of even 6 months could cost people jobs, time, money. It's incredible. And the uncertainty that we have nowadays is just unfathomable.
This is John. Mona, a few moments ago, you were describing why it's unreasonable for the government to take so long. And that's exactly the point. The law actually is very favorable to us in these situations, because all we have to do is talk about whether or not what the agency is doing under processing times is reasonable. If it takes 6.25 hours to do a 526, how is it reasonable for them to take 4 years to give you an answer?
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
That is just, like Brad was mentioning, we've been on the other side of this where we've been in court trying to defend the agency. And there were times, many, many times in this scenario, where we would pick up the phone, call the agency and say, I'm not defending you. You are going to make a decision before we have to roll into court and answer. You have 60 days to make a decision. Make it. Because this is ridiculous. Because I'm going to get chewed out by an Article 3 judge when I try to explain why this is legit.
Mm. Okay. So, gentlemen, one of the questions that we receive often when we are asked by clients and they discuss the possibility of litigation is the cost. Is the cost so unbearable that it's like, oh, wow, we would love to litigate, but we can't afford to?
So this is Brad. I think the cost is for actual delay litigation is going to be less than any of the investors ever imagine. And that's a function of what type of lawsuit it is. This is not a lawsuit you would ever see a TV drama about, because it is very boring. There is no jury. There is no discovery. If anyone's been involved in litigation, civil litigation, you know that that's where you end up racking up a lot of time and a lot of dollars. There is no discovery. In fact, it typically goes like this. You file a complaint saying the delay is unreasonable. If the government responds, they respond. You brief that one issue. So there is some legal briefing, and that's the end of the case. Whoever wins, wins. That's it. It's a very limited, narrow case. Typically, what we see, at least in this context, is a lot of people charge a flat fee rather than hourly. That also helps you know your cost up front, because it can't change if it's a flat fee. And again, I think it's going to be less than what the investors expect. And I also, just as a matter of economics, if you can get a decision 2 years earlier, you're going to end up saving money by going through this litigation and getting a decision. And
I quite agree. But gentlemen, you must have had decisions which were not favorable, and clients who said, oh God, I wish I didn't litigate.
So interestingly enough, no. So our first clients—
Is that a no?
Yeah, no. Our clients have reported actually quite the opposite. Starting in 2018 is when we first started filing a lot of suits. Many of our clients had denial rates of, 50, 60% in 2018.
Not in the EB-5 context.
Yeah, not in the EB-5 context. So 2019, after they had filed suit in 2018, their approval rates are in the high 90s, where their peer companies that they were competing for visas with were down in the 40s and 50s, like they were the year before. So that anecdotal evidence is pretty strong that the agency just does not like to be sued, and they try to avoid litigation as much as possible. And if you've just shown yourself to be aggressive, they tend to stay away from you.
And I'll just note two other things. First off, as a former government attorney, the easiest case to settle to get off of my docket so that I can go home early on a Friday is a delay suit.
Yeah.
Because all the agency has to do is make a decision. And so I have every interest in calling them and saying, make a decision. That's all it takes. And the case simply goes away, which for an investor means it settles and you get agency action, right? Now, the second point of that is if that agency action is negative, if they decide to deny, you're already in court. And there's mechanisms under the federal rules of civil procedure to amend your complaint and now challenge the denial. So you're ahead of the game. You're not going to go through a futile administrative appeal. And now the agency is going to have to justify, right, that denial. And by the way, it certainly looks bad in front of a judge. If you filed a delay suit, the agency took action to get rid of it and then took negative action against you, you automatically have this atmospheric kind of feeling that the agency's out to get your client. And if you're writing your briefs properly, you're hammering them with that. And I can tell you in a case just this past month, not an EB-5 case, but another employment-based case, we challenged the delay. They denied. We challenged the denial. And within 1 week, they reopened and approved. And that visa had been denied for 2 years at that point.
Gentlemen, almost every project that we deal with tells us that they have congressional support. Would congressional support assist and avoid litigation?
So I'll answer that with a story. Once upon a time when I was working at USCIS, I was with a very high up person in the agency in his office, shooting the bull, so to speak, just hanging out, talking on a Friday. A member of Congress called angry and irate about the way one of their constituents had been treated by USCIS. The secretary pops her head in and says, "Congressman X is on the line, very upset." And my boss and I both look at each other, start maniacally laughing, because we both know that doesn't matter, because Congress isn't writing our checks. Congress isn't paying our bills. Our bills come from the fees. Congress has no real, absent changing the Immigration and Nationality Act, Congress has no impact on the way that agency operates. So I would say congressional pressure, if your congressman is on the right committee, if he's on a committee that actually can really stick it to the agency, maybe, but otherwise, no.
And I will just follow up with that. When I was a litigator defending these delays and I got the file from the client or from the agency, the first thing I would do is go through and remove all of the letters to Congress, congressmen from congressmen, because they were completely irrelevant to my analysis of defending that delay or not.
Well, unfortunately, what we are seeing is that there has become not only a niche, but an absolute need for litigation to enter into this arena. And not just for the odd case or two, but for us, what we are seeing for perhaps a lot of cases. And your views on that, please.
We think in today's world, litigation is a necessary part of this business, both from the projects side as well as the investors side. And it's unfortunate it's come to that, but the more litigation, the more the agency will be held in check. And the more the agency will be held in check, the better the decisions, the faster the decisions. And we just think right now of all times, it's a great time to sue the government.
Yeah, I would like to just finalize this, Mark, because again, we do have a lot of listeners overseas who are scared to sue the government, that America does give you this, grants this right as a constitutional right.
It gives you the constitutional right. And then there's also the practical reality. And the practical reality is, in order to carry out a campaign of retribution or retaliation, you've got to have two things. You've got to have ambition and competence. And those are two things that aren't widely found in the federal government. So I think we're okay there. And the other thing to consider is that litigation is incredibly time consuming for the government attorneys, well, both at USCIS and also for DOJ. And the more litigation that they encounter, the less they're going to be able to mess with you through ridiculous RFEs, ridiculous denial letters. The more they get swamped with litigation, the better the entire immigration landscape is going to benefit.
Thank you. Thank you both of you for joining us today and giving us your insight, your valuable insight.
Thank you, Mona.
Thank you, Mona.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.